Welcome back, everybody, to the Classic Rock Podcast. And coming up in this edition of the show, we're going to be talking to Billy Morrison from his home in LA about the brand new solo album, which is coming. It's called The Morrison Project. It's due in the next few weeks or so. Billy left the shores, what, in the mid-1990s to go and seek out his fame and fortune in LA. And it found him pretty quickly as well. He ended up playing with The Cult and latterly, of course, alongside Steve Stevens with Billy Idol and his band playing around the stadiums and the arenas of the world. Now, not only is Billy an in-demand and highly sought-after musician, but he's also an accomplished artist as well. And he's an actor. He's played alongside David Duchovny and Rob Lowe in Californication, as well as numerous film roles. He's also an accomplished radio presenter, a podcast producer and a host. And he is best friend to the rock and roll icon that is Ozzy Osbourne, who you can see is actually on the album as well, playing in this video alongside me. It's Crack Cocaine. And we'll be talking a bit about that in the upcoming interview. So, plenty to talk about in the next half an hour or so, including where this story began, where the love of performance, the love of music first was spawned. It was in London, the back end of the 70s, as a 10-year-old kid. He's upstairs in his bedroom, on the record player, never mind the bollocks by the Sex Pistols. Within a year, the bedroom door shut again, he's got guitar in hand and he's learning how to crank out those power chords, and thus began the journey to rock and roll stardom. It starts and ends with the Sex Pistols then. The moment I heard them, that was the moment that I knew that I wanted to be in this business. Now, when you heard them, you couldn't have been any more than 7 or 8, could you?
No, I was 10. Yeah, I was 10 years old, and I was already a bit of a tearaway, you know, like,
yeah.
I hadn't put all the pieces together, but I knew I felt like an alien on this planet, and I wasn't heard, and I didn't feel seen, and I just was looking. At 10 years old, how do I make my mark in this world? And I saw the Pistols, and it was like a light bulb went off him. Like, I watched a whole country have the most ridiculously overreactive, you know, the overreaction because a couple of teenagers swore on TV was
this is the Bill Grundy thing.
Yeah, I watched that, yeah. And I watched my parents' reaction, and then I saw the headlines the next day, and I just went, oh, that's what you've got to do to be seen and heard in this life. And it just changed everything.
It was the whole danger thing. I can imagine what it was like, because I was born in pretty much the same era as you, and right. And it was dangerous. You know, it was like you'd see punks on the street and you'd think, I can't go near them. I don't know what, you know, it's all very dangerous.
There's the difference between you and I. I saw the punks on the street and I ran up to them going, how can I be like you? You know, what it was, I understood from the get-go that it was an overreaction, that separation between teenagers and adults, they drew the line in the sand with a swear word and a bunch of power chords. And I did not see the issue with that. The country did. The country was like, oh, my God. You know, they said a four-letter word on TV, and I was looking and going, well, so what? You know, and it was a combination of that plus the song Anarchy in the UK made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Now, I don't know why. That's just – it's a physical reaction to hearing Steve Jones play that riff. I'm not in control of that, you know. Yeah, so. Yeah. So the hairs on the back of my neck stood up with the music, and my eyes saw what they were screaming about. I mean, in 77 and 78, there were trash strikes in London. And yeah, yeah. I remember going on a school field trip up to the Houses of Parliament and looking at one of the most opulent and wealthy buildings I'd ever seen, surrounded by 9-foot-high piles of trash. And my 10-year-old head went, there's something wrong here. These punks have got it right, and that was it.
And your first musical instrument, you're up in your bedroom learning the chords to Never Mind the Bollocks.
Yeah.
Behind closed doors. How'd your parents take your interest in being a punk and punk rock music and learning to play the guitar and wanting to be one?
You know, our house where I grew up was a typical English terraced, you know, two up, yeah. two down. And I was up and they were down. And my old man used to stand at the bottom of the stairs screaming, "Turn that shit down." Because I had Never Mind the Bollocks on repeat and I was trying to learn the chords. It's a fond memory of my youth, you know.
I know you had that the Love for the Pistols. What about the other bands of the time, the other punk bands of the time, the likes of, I know, Susie and the Banshees, Jimmy Percy and Sham 69, Stiff Little Fingers. I mean, there's some at the Clash, the Jam. I mean, yeah. it was an amazing time.
Yeah, it was. Look, so I was about 2 or 3 years too young to be able to just do what I wanted. What I wanted, but I kept getting caught and grounded and all the rest of it, you know. But at 11 years old, I went up to World's End, which was then Seditionaries, with my pocket money and bought a muslin shirt with Anarchy in the UK Sex Pistols. And, you know, I would hide it from my parents and then put it on at school and then not go to school and go up to the West End and run around. And I was a huge fan of, so my other bands were Adam and the Ants, before the White Stripe, before all that rubbish, you know, when he was
Dog
wearing,
Eat Dog.
Yeah, before all that.
Young Parisians.
And even, believe it or not, before that, the Ants originally were a sex band, you know. He had no shirt and rubber pants on, and he was singing about bondage and you know, I was 11. I was like, this is amazing, you know. And Generation X were my other band as well, the original Generation X, which is bizarre considering who I am.
Billy Idol.
But I saw almost all the bands. I never saw the Sex Pistols back then. And, you know, to be honest, if everyone who said they saw the Sex Pistols actually saw them, they would have been doing Wembley Stadium for 3 weeks because, you know, their career lasted about 21 months and 12 songs. That was it.
You did climb through the window at the Marquee Club, didn't you, to see Generation X?
And the Lyceum. I did. I was a bit of a tearaway. And I used to bunk off school. I never went to school, and I'd get the train up to the West End and just stay up there. I got caught nicking the NME. They had this wonderful store on Old Compton Street that sold Sounds and NME and Record Mirror. Yeah. And I used to go in there and load up with all the Pistols. When the Pistols were on the front cover, I'd be nicking it. And I remember, you know, at 11 years old, running down the street trying to get away from some guy because I'd nicked a Record Mirror or something.
You had a difficult time though, didn't you, in your early teens into your 20s? Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of quotes you made over time saying, you know, you've been in a lot of bands, but, yeah, and this was the quote of yours, I was actually pursuing a pro-heroin career. But you were luckier than most, weren't you? Because unlike many who didn't live to see another day, you're sat behind a rubbish bin or a trash can in King's Cross and you're trying to shoot crack and you have a moment, don't you? And it's like, if I die, who cares? Nobody cares. And it's amazing, isn't it, that one thought is then enough to change your whole life.
You know, Tim, first of all, I did actively pursue a career as a heroin addict, basically because I was too young and stupid to know what that actually meant. I didn't know about getting a habit and being dependent. What I knew is Johnny Thunders looked really skinny. Sid had the greatest haircut in the world. And, you know, Keith looked like he didn't care. And when you're young and 14, that's you just want to be skinny and good looking and not give a shit what people think. So I didn't know what it meant, but I knew the correlation between all these people was heroin. And I was hanging around a band that had heroin issues and I was offered heroin and I took it and it made me feel like I was invincible. It made me feel sleepy, you know, and warm, like the little womb feeling, you know, that I would imagine how it feels in a womb. And I did not understand the ramifications of doing it every day. And I went for it with a vengeance. And 15 years later, I had that moment that you described where it was clear. It wasn't a cry for help. It was, oh shit, I'm actually going to die. I was, you know, without getting too graphic, I was covered in blood. And all the people at lunchtime in King's Cross, all the business people, they're walking past me, you know, just looking at me. And I had this moment, if I die, and I'm going to die, no one's going to give a shit. And I didn't want to go out like that. You know, obviously deeper than the desire to be skinny and not give a shit was a desire to actually create and leave a somewhat of an impression on the world and not go out early. And so that was my moment.
You went over to LA, you dropped over to LA, you loved it so much, you couldn't wait to get back. And things happened very quickly for you when you got over there, because within an instant, you're working with the Cult. I mean, huge band.
Yeah, God love Billy Duffy. You know, I've known Billy since I was a teenager, and he'll tell you stories. You know, a lot of my using was done in Brixton, and he actually had a room. He wasn't using drugs, but he had a room. It was a big squat mentality in Brixton, so everyone lived everywhere, right? And he had a room in the place that I used to go and score. And he will tell you stories that his room was triple locked to keep the junkies out. And then when he needed to go out, he'd unlock all the locks, and he would be stepping over my, you know, I was out like a light, lying on the living room floor. And he'll tell you, I used to step over Morrison's body to get out to go to the store. So God love him, when I did get my shit together and came to America, he called me and said, listen, do you want to join the Cult? Actually, it was, do you want to audition? Which I did, and I got the job. So, yeah, he was quite responsible for giving me that leg up, because I was in stadiums straight away. It was kind of weird.
You talked about the work ethic as well when you got over there. And basically, if you're prepared to get out there and put in the road miles and to put in the work and basically do more than the other guy, you will get a level of success. And so that's been your mantra. You know, you get out there, you do as much as you can in the time that you've got, and you will have success.
Well, yeah, because I'm playing catch up. If you imagine, imagine this, I woke up from that narcotic haze and I was 29. Now, most of my peers formed bands when they were 17, got a platinum record by the time they were 21, you know, had some real estate in their lives, and then went and got a heroin habit, which, you know, is still gnarly. But I woke up at 29 without a pot to piss in, no career, no money. So, of course, it's a decision. This is a second chance in life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to waste it. And I do see a lot of people. Look, I live in LA where everyone's an actor. You know, the person bringing your coffee at a coffee shop's an actor, a poet, an artist, a musician. And yet I see 90% of them expecting Steven Spielberg to walk in and go, you are the lead in my next movie. And that is not how the world works. So if you want a career, you better work hard.
We then had Camp Freddy, the Royal the Machines. And this all begins with that meeting with Son of Donovan in that an opening a hotel in downtown LA. I mean, again, another fortuitous, well, I'm not going to say luck, but a fortuitous moment.
It was, and I think that has been, that's really my ethos. If you'd have asked me before that, if you'd have said to me, you're going to form the world's greatest covers band, I would have laughed. I would have said, I've got no interest in playing covers. But you have to go where the energy is. Mm. And you also have to learn to say yes you know, and not know. So when Son of Donovan, called me and said, can you put an all-star band together and open it? We'll just play six songs, covers. Something in me went, well, yeah, why not? Why not? I'm not a big star. It doesn't matter. Who cares? Let's have some fun. And I called some friends, and over 23 years later, we're still playing massive gigs, and that band has been going for 23 years. It's an example of knowing, not being precious. Just say yes.
Yeah, yeah. Camp Freddy. Did that name come from the character in The Italian Job?
Yes, it did. Because we none
how
of us
many people knew that.
No one. And here's the thing. We didn't know we were going to be going for 23 years. We thought it was one gig. And what does a name matter? And they were putting the flyer together and they went, what's the band name? And I love that movie character. And I just went, fuck it, call it Camp Freddy. And it stuck. Until we changed the name to Royal Machines, everyone would be like, what's Camp Freddy? Oh, God.
I love it. So you knew Steve Stevens as well. What was it like getting the, having the conversation with him about getting to work with Billy Idol?
Well, that was life-changing, obviously, because as a guitar player, first of all, Steve Stevens is very intimidating. He's one of the world's greatest players and I think one of the most underrated. And secondly, you know, Billy Idol fronted Generation X, one of my favorite punk bands. And just being on the phone going, are you sure you've got the right guy, Steve? You know, and he was sure and he had a lot of faith in me. And I would say Steve is single-handedly responsible for me growing up as a musician. You can't be in a band with Steve Stevens and not have a dramatic increase in your ability and your talent, because you have to, because he's saying things like, play this, but play it a third above me. And you're copying what Steve's doing in harmony. It's like, it's crazy. And you have to get better really quickly.
You did say how lucky you felt at the time. And you said, it's like every time I walk onto the stage, I get this feeling that someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and go, no, hang on a minute, not you, the younger, skinnier bloke over there in the corner.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with the research you've done, because that quote, I stopped saying that quote a long time ago. So I'm very impressed. And that is the absolute truth. A psychiatrist would tell you it's part of the addictive mind, but I have the less than complex. I've never felt good enough as I am to be a member of society. Now I'm working on that and I feel a lot better. But I can tell you, I walked out onto the stage in front of 75,000 people a couple of weeks ago in Mexico with Billy Idol and Steve Stevens, and I take front and center many times throughout the gig. I'm embraced as a member of the band. I've written songs. And when I walked out, I'm thinking, they don't mean me. There's got to be someone younger. That's what goes through my head.
You're obviously at this time in your life around then feeling energized as a creator of art, not just in terms of music, because all of a sudden, well, maybe not all of a sudden, but the acting roles start to come in, and you're playing alongside David Duchovny, Rob Lowe in Californication, and how cool was that? I mean, and your character, I love your character, Sweaty Steve.
You know, I think, again, that's an example of don't pigeonhole yourself, you know. I just love creating on all mediums. You know, I have a fine art career. I've done a fair bit of acting. I'm a musician. I'm on the radio. And that's just as a result of saying yes to things that you didn't know you wanted. And also being able to just... you got to keep it in, because I walked on set and there's David Duchovny and Rob Lowe and they're like, hey buddy, how you doing? I'm just like, I'm good. You know, like, keep that shit down and you're there to do a job. And that attitude has served me well. Don't overthink it either. I mean, you know, especially with acting, not everyone can do it, but certainly
less
for me,
is more, isn't it?
No one wants an overactor.
Jack Lemmon. I remember a great quote from Jack Lemmon. It was just like, less.
Absolutely. I know that quote. No one wants to see hugely dramatic cameos in Californication. You just got to be yourself and, you know, remember your lines and you'll be all right.
And so the art. You, Ozzy's giving you a bit of a thing about, you know, pick up a, do you need to do some drawing? You need to do some painting and whatever. And you're in South America, you buy a canvas, you got four colors. And then that's another life-changing moment because you're off on a career as an artist. I mean, how is it you went through 29 years before you started the battle, got cleaned up and got the band going, and you never knew that you could paint, draw, write a lyric? Well, maybe not write a lyric because you were doing that, but certainly painting.
I had no idea. And look, Tim, it's another example. First of all, if I like something and if I enjoy the process, I do it every day. Anyone, it's nothing special to me. Anyone that paints every day for 10 years is going to get good at it. You would get good at it. Even if you're shit when you start, it's a matter of learning and having an open mind and not trying to be perfect straight away. And Ozzy's encouragement, again, another life-changing moment. And again, if you'd have said you're going to be a painter, I would have laughed. I mean, I didn't go to art in school. I didn't go to school. So
yeah, you made a great quote when you said that we were always brought up to believe that if you hadn't had years of training, then yeah, you can't do it. It's not for you.
And that's what the Pistols did for me. None of them had any training, and look at what they changed in the music business. And punk rock, it was an attitude, not a haircut. And I took that and ran with it, and I still run with it. I've never had an art lesson in my life, but I have a full-on fine art career in galleries. Like, I can't keep up with it. And that's just because I don't care that I didn't go to the Royal Academy of Art. And neither do all the hundreds of people that buy my paintings. So it kind of shows that that's a truthful way to live. It doesn't matter how you – what matters is you've got something worth saying in the first place.
You've had an appreciation of art, though. From when you were a kid. It was the Velvet Underground thing, wasn't it, with drugs and transvestites, the whole pop art, the Warhol thing. So it was always something that interested you.
That'll be the quote that they take out of context and go, Billy Morrison liked art and transvestites. I think that the visual art has always stimulated me. I never thought I could do it, obviously. But my house, as you can see, is covered in pop art and modern art. Banksy, Keith Haring, Shepard Fairey, Andy Warhol, Basquiat. And I find that the statements those artists made when they and still make are punk rock, left of center, upset the norm. And that really is subvert from the inside is a great quote. I'm successful and I'm living a wonderful life. But that doesn't mean I have to put a painting of trees and a landscape in an old gold frame in my house. I don't have to do that. So art does for me the same as music does for me.
Your works have been described as mixing dark imagery with political statement and puzzle pieces. Where I get the first two bits. Where do the puzzle pieces come? Because I mean, I've looked at the artwork and you see the puzzle pieces dropped in there. So what is the meaning behind that?
Well, I think that when we all go to bed at night and put our head on the pillow, life can often seem like a puzzle. And we are all often wondering, well, how did that happen? And where did I go wrong? Or what do I do with this situation? It's like a jigsaw puzzle. Life is a jigsaw puzzle to me. And sometimes I find the corner piece and I put the corner piece in and then 10 other pieces fit together. And other times I'm staring at the puzzle going, where is this piece? It could be a relationship. It could be financial issues. It could be anything in life, but we all are just trying to put that puzzle together. So a jigsaw puzzle imagery to me is a visual way of describing if you leave a couple of pieces out and paint them black, it describes all of our lives. I think you're very lucky if you're living a life where the puzzle got put together when you were 15 and you've never had an issue since. I'd like to meet that person.
So let's get on to the Morrison project then.
Yeah.
And the beauty for you of being where you're based in LA for 20 or 25 odd years, 30 years, is the contacts that you've built up over the years. You can just sit down, flip open the book and think, right, let's see, who can we get involved in this project? And you just have an A-list cast that just roll in and help put together the album. I mean, well, it must be great.
I'm lucky. But I have to say, that was not how it happened. I didn't even know I was making a record. I was just messing around in COVID. And when I did eventually start to put all the ideas together, I was singing songs. That's why six of the songs on the album I sung.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to learn, or I learned anyway, that sometimes it's a lot better to serve the song and not your own ego. And for instance, when I got to the piano ballad, I'd written that piano ballad in its entirety. And I tried to sing it. And clearly, I am not the guy that the world wants to hear singing Chasing Shadows.
Yeah.
So to serve the song rather than put out something where I sound a bit funky on it, obviously, Linda is a close friend. All of these guests that are on the album are not people that I went through managers or agents to get. They're all people that over the years, and yes, they are A-listers, but they're my friends. And I apologize to the world that some of my friends are some of the biggest rock artists in the world, but they are. So I called all of them and said, look, I have a song. Would you consider singing it? And to their credit, not one person hummed and hawed. They all went, Billy, of course. Because, for instance, Al Jurgensen, I've written songs for the last couple of Ministry albums. There's no money, there's no credit, nothing. It's because I love Al. So, of course, I've done that for Al. When I call up and go, listen, you're singing a song on my album now, he's like, yeah, come over, let's do it. Same with all of them.
Everybody was initially drawn to the one song, Crack Cocaine, with Ozzy Osbourne. But the album is far greater than just this. It does have, I thought, and maybe that's because we maybe grew up in the same era, it does have that 70s punk feel to it, dressed up to make it relevant in the 21st century, because there's no point in doing an album that sounds 40, 50 years ago. Huh. It's got the attitude of then and the sound of now.
Clearly, I do Angry Boy quite well. I mean, I guess the inside me is still that 11 and 12-year-old punk rock kid screaming to get out. So clearly, I do the Angry Boy quite well. And there is a cohesiveness to the whole record, which again is, it's not by design. I did not sit down and put these 12 songs together and think this is a cohesive album. It just happened. But that's because all the music was written and performed by me, and the imagery on the album and everything that goes together in putting an album together, that's all from my heart. So the fact that Corey Taylor sings a song or Al Jurgensen sings a song, it's still my music. It's still part of the vision that I eventually crafted for this album. And yeah, it's a pretty dystopian view, but we've all just come out of a global pandemic, riots, financial collapse. I'm not writing an album about, rainbows and unicorns. It's just not what I was feeling at the time.
What else is good here is it's a reminder of what music used to be like back then, because you've got 12 tracks in here. The longest one is 4 minutes and 20. It's like the old adage, isn't it? Don't bore us, get to the chorus, and we've got 3.5 minute, 4 minute songs, 12 of them straight through. Album's done in 40 minutes, and you've had a good time listening to it.
I really appreciate that, Tim, because again, because I wasn't trying to craft a song for radio and the second single, and there's none of that was in my head. I just didn't really know what I was doing. But what I did, what I was passionate about is I don't subscribe to the 8-song album. You know, an album is 12 songs. I remember growing up opening a gatefold sleeve, so my vinyl is all gatefold. There's credits to read. There's a story and a journey throughout those 12 songs. So when you're not feeling the pressure of a label and marketing and all of that stuff in the business, you're free to write the album and put together the album that would turn you on as a 14-year-old.
You've said that you are absolutely not political. How difficult is it, though, to produce an album talking about the subjects that you are talking about in this album without being political?
That's a great question. And I think the key to it is make political observations rather than political opinions. Just because I'm apolitical, that's based upon my belief that neither side tell any of us the truth. Right. So basically, if neither side are telling you the truth, how can you make an educated opinion and vote? Like, all voting is basically, well, lesser of two evils, whatever your opinion is. So rather than write a politically opinionated song, I would write from an observational standpoint, which is we're all fucked. And we all know that. We all know that it's a complete mess out there. Well, so that's a political statement, but it's true. So it's an observational standpoint.
Lyrics come easy to you.
Yeah.
Again, you've said this in the past, but I'm such a dark person. I view the world differently. Yeah. What does that mean?
It means that lyrics are important and that I can only write what I feel. And if one other person relates to that feeling or that statement, then I'm winning. So all I do is I watch the news. You know, the news is on sometimes in the background here, or I listen when I'm out at dinner with my friends, and I write from an observational standpoint in the hope that when someone else is listening to a song like It's Come to This, you know, which is basically a story about a fantasy in my head of just selling everything, leaving everything even, don't even sell it, get in the car, drive to the desert and find something more important than how to pay the mortgage, how to pay the electric bill. Can I go on vacation this year? Is there a country that I can go on vacation to these days?
That's a good one.
And I just write from my observation and hope that someone else relates to it, but it ends up being a little dark.
Do you ever find yourself in a position where if you're writing a song, you sometimes stop and think, it's giving me a piece of inspiration for art, or the other way around, where you're actually painting something and you stop and think, Christ, this is it. Song title. I've got it. Here it is.
Always. That's one of the joys of having you know, multiple disciplines that are careers is, yeah, I'll be painting something, and even color choices will suddenly get me, you know, if I'm painting reds to yellow, my head will go to a sunrise, and then my head will go, you know, sunrise in the apocalypse, and now I'm upstairs like writing a riff, or the other way around. Yeah, I mean, I love creativity keeps me out of jail. That's a true standpoint, because left to my own devices, clearly that 15-year period of drug abuse, I was left to my own devices with no creativity, and I ended up in that life. So creativity is a lifesaver for me.
The song Crack Cocaine, what was amazing here to me immediately was that every media outlet suddenly picked up and said, Ozzy, what's crack cocaine? God, it's glorification of drugs. It's glorification of this. And it was amazing because not one of them read the story of the song or the lyrics. It just shows you how the media's not changed.
No, it's not changed, of course. And that's why me and Ozzy put out that little teaser where Ozzy was talking about it not being about drugs. But you know, when we were advised, look, Ozzy's my best friend and he's absolutely brilliant. And at one point we had this big Zoom discussion call where people were like, if you change the title, you'll get more radio play. And both of us went, fuck off. Read the lyrics, you know, and we've proven, because the song is a hit. They use this word, a hit, right? I guess it's a hit. Millions and millions of things happening and chart positions and all that that I never thought I would get. So fuck them. Read the lyrics. It's nothing to do about with drugs at all.
Thank you.
So was there a moment then after you sat down and listened to that song back and thought, actually, this is so good, I think I'll keep it for myself for my next solo album, because it was such a great track and he's sounding as good on that as he has done for years?
Well, yeah, just because he's gone through some health issues doesn't mean the guy isn't a rock and roll icon and he can't sing. And you'd have to ask Ozzy that, and maybe he did have that thought, but the truth of the matter is Ozzy and Sharon are the most generous people on the planet. And right from the word go, Sharon and Ozzy both said, you need to release this song. This is your song. Ozzy will sing on it. He'll do the video. He'll do some press. This is all you, Billy. And so here we are.
So touring plans, anybody going to get to see this out on the road? Are you going to play it anywhere? It seems too good to just sort of go, well, here's the album, right? That's it. See you again soon.
Yeah, but if I was to do it live, I wouldn't want to do it in a watered down version. So I would need Al Jurgensen and Corey Taylor and Ozzy Osbourne. And yeah, how do you do that? Now, a one-off or maybe two-off in a weekend, you know? Do a Phil Collins, we'll get on a plane and we'll do London and LA. I don't know. If someone's got a massive checkbook, they can call me up and we can discuss it. It's not dead in the water, but I wouldn't want to go and tour this and sing them myself, because that's watering down what the music actually is.
What would a success for you be then with this album?
April
charting, 19th. Lots of great reviews, whatever.
No, the success is April 19th when the album drops and I can leave those 12 songs as a statement that says this album is Billy Morrison. This is what he's about. Read the lyrics, listen to the music. That's a success. Everything else, they keep calling me every day and going, you're at 2 million views and you're at this and we're number this in this chart. And I just go, okay, great. I'm super grateful. But none of that matters. What matters is when I die, there is a body of work, 12 songs that really I'm proud of and that I hope people go on to listen to in years.
What was your favorite song on the album?
Oh, man, it's so hard. I mean, Drowning, that's why we released Drowning as the first single, because it's just that riff is undeniable. And when the riff was written, you know that it's a winning riff. I think We Are the Dead is also one of my favorite songs, just because it's the most lyrically personal I've ever written.
And Chasing Shadows at the end. I mean, there's vibes of various people. You can pick out influences here, there, and everywhere on the album. But Chasing Shadows, I was just sat there listening to it thinking, what a great song this is. And I kept thinking of David Bowie.
Of course. It's the Bowie song that I wish Bowie had sung, you know. Look, Linda Perry is a huge Bowie fan, and I sent her that song, and she said, this is a perfect song. I don't want to change a thing. I will sing it for you, which as a songwriter is huge that Linda Perry, of all people, says this song is fine as it is. And I like to end, look, just because I'm Angry Boy, I am also human. And I have emotions, and I'm able to write a piano ballad that means something. And to have Linda sing it was just—it was icing on the cake. She absolutely killed it.
Going back to the acting thing, there was, of course, the news that Spinal Tap 2 is coming out, with all manner of people getting involved in that. Would you like to be in it?
Oh,
any chance of you getting on that?
I'll say this: if the producers and the casting people of Spinal Tap 2 want me to be in it, it would be an absolute honor. I very much doubt they even know who I am, but if they do and they watch this, I'm in 100%.
And lastly, then, tell us a bit about your new project, the Madhouse Chronicles with Ozzy. What is it all about?
It's all about life. It when they pitched me the concept, I was at, absolutely, I'll do it. It's basically what you get to see in the Madhouse Chronicles is exactly how me and Ozzy are when cameras are not rolling or we're not in a studio. We're just mates. And so what they got us to do was just watch all these crazy internet videos and just talk. And I mean, half of the show is me and him laughing. not even saying anything because we crack each other up. So it really is a look inside the friendship, which I love.